Mark chapter 5, this is the last part of this chapter. Power to restore relationships. And this quote, what Mark has joined together, the preacher should not put asunder. So, as per this quote, this lengthy section needs to be handled together. Both stories involve women. There's two stories that we're going to be covering. Both involve disease and impurity. They both use the phrase 12 years, and the word daughter comes up in both.
Okay.
This is another example of Mark's sandwich rhetoric, where the starting narrative is interrupted by a second story, and then the first narrative continues after the second one. So, when we read these stories then, in this particular rhetorical format, these connections are where Mark's intentions are found. Another quote here, both stories are also, of course, stories of women and belong to Mark's focus on Jesus's regard for and attention to women. His first story then begins with Jairus and his sick little girl. So chapter 5 verses 21 through 24. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he went with him. Trying a different format and ordering to this outline and discussion. Putting a bunch of commentary before some questions.
Okay.
So I guess I have here two selections from a commentary. Having crossed geographical boundaries to release a Gentile from bondage to destroyer, Jesus returns to Jewish territory where his healing power crosses traditional impurity boundaries to restore life to two suffering women. Unlike most characters in the Gospel, he, speaking of Jairus, is important enough to have a name the reader might recognize. He is a man in a man's world, holds a respected position that implies both wealth and religious enfranchisement, and owns an unusually large house with a separate room in which his daughter may convalesce. This is a person accustomed to getting what he wants. The request is both eloquent and detailed in its expectations. My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. Jesus cooperates, and for a brief moment, it looks like things may go Jairus' way, as always. So, some questions here. How might geography inform our reading and interpretation? Where was Jesus prior to this? It says Jesus crossed again in the boat to the other side.
Where was he?
Where did he come from? Right before this. He's probably in Capernaum now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In the two stories previously, we had the story of the storm and the story of the demoniac. Jesus and his disciples were in the region of Gerasenes, Decapolis. Which is a Gentile area.
Okay. And that's why it's significant that when he freed the demoniac and he told him to stay where you are and tell your friends, and came back later and was more accepted.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Jesus returns to Jewish territory.
And this is a ruler of the Jews, the man he's talking to.
It's ruler of the Jews. Mm-hmm. It is a... It's where religious and civil life are always together.
Church and state are very much the same.
So, this story, it doesn't exactly say where, but it could have happened in Capernaum. It's in that region where earlier, chronologically, in Luke chapter 7, Jesus heals a centurion's servant by merely speaking. This centurion was known to have been a supporter of the Jews, providing funds for building of their synagogue. So if that was the case, which quite a few scholars do believe that there's probably a connection, how might this experience have affected Jairus, knowing that this healing took place earlier?
He would be more willing to go to Jesus and have confidence that he would and could do what he's asking.
Yeah, so he has prior experience and knowledge about what happened. So he might be more willing to go. On the other hand, by this time, the religious leaders have openly stated and shown their opposition to Jesus. We see that in chapter 3. So what did Jairus risk by coming to Jesus? What would prompt Jairus to risk coming to Jesus?
So his daughter,
point of death, in desperation.
Yeah. He knows that there's one person who can do these things. And even though he has fallen out of favor.
Now, the leader of a synagogue is not part of the clergy. It's just a lay person.
More like a civil leader of a religious organization.
Right. Definitely not part of the priestly caste, not a Levite.
Okay. Huh. Interesting.
Doesn't say whether Jairus was a Pharisee or not. It was just a leader of... there were multiple leaders. And they would preside over the services. They would preside over the functioning of the synagogue.
Interesting.
Jairus probably sought help from all other avenues.
First. The approved religious healers or whatever.
So, how does Jairus approach Jesus, and what might that say about him? Jairus, he falls at Jesus' feet and implores him earnestly.
He's desperate by this time.
And what is Jesus' response?
Sure, I'll go.
Let's go.
Yeah. Then we get to the middle. It's about a woman, 12 years. An outcast. So, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." So, some commentaries here. The desire to touch Jesus' clothing probably reflects the popular belief that the dignity and power of a person are transferred to what he wears. On this understanding, her touch combined faith with quasi-magical notions which were widespread in that day. Mm-hmm. Jesus wants to know who touched him because he has relational business with her, which is even more pressing than her disease, or even the little girl's deathly illness. He claims the woman as daughter and clarifies the cause of her healing. It is her faith in him, not magic, that has made this happen. By an act of sovereign will, God determined to honor the woman's faith in spite of the fact that it was tinged with ideas which bordered on magic. In Mark's telling, the power gets away from Jesus and into the woman without so much as a nod of consent on his part. In her own strange way, she has been in complete control up to now, but this is more than she bargained for. Mark frequently mentions crowds. What role do they play in the present narratives?
Well, this woman probably doesn't spend much time in crowds. Women who are on their period are unclean.
12 years.
Supposed to stay at home and just, I don't know what they did, but you're unclean when you're on your period and you don't go around people.
Yeah, and she went there and she knew that she would get better. It wasn't, well, maybe if I go. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to think that way. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting also that she immediately knew that it had stopped.
It must have been that bad after 12 years. And
maybe.
No.
Maybe.
So, these crowds, you know, in all these stories, the crowds kind of...
The crowds are kind of a passive, go-with-the-flow entity.
They follow Jesus, but they don't express any kind of faith.
Mm-hmm. The crowds don't take initiative. They're just the people who follow, well, the crowd.
They also are kind of a barrier. They get in the way mm-hmm. of people mm-hmm. who really want to come to Jesus. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people who do have the initiative and are trying to get Jesus have to
wade through.
Yeah, yeah. There's the barrier there of all of the passive followers.
So this woman had probably spent most of her adulthood with this debilitating condition. Mm-hmm. 12 years, the average lifespan is probably 40 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. So she could never become ritually clean, and thus she's barred from religious services. Her ritual impurity could be transmitted to others, mm-hmm. thus rendering her a social outcast. In a society that placed prime importance on community and, for women, childbearing, mm-hmm. she was a non-person. Mm-hmm. In her desperation, she sought out every possible remedy. And here's a note. One remedy consisted of drinking a goblet of wine containing a powder compounded from rubber, alum, and garden crocuses. Another treatment consisted of a dose of Persian onions cooked in wine administered with the summons, "Arise out of your flow of blood." Other physicians prescribed sudden shock or the carrying of the ash of an ostrich egg in a certain cloth. Those were some of the treatments. There were other treatments that involved placing things in the mm-hmm. woman's body.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Fun. And, you know, think about having to wear a menstrual cloth, not just modern sanitary napkins, every single day for 12 years.
No, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention, like you mentioned, childbearing is a mandatory part of womanhood.
Was she even ever able to have kids?
She probably had not. And
so she was nobody
to
them.
Yeah.
But not Jesus.
She was an unclean woman, not a mother. Yeah.
So she heard he was there through the crowd, probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if she had to sneak out. Could she be seen out and about?
I don't know.
Probably knew.
Probably.
Everyone probably knew who she was. So, this next question is, why does a woman seek secrecy in her approach to Jesus?
I think we went there. Yeah.
So what does her
shame?
What does her actions tell us about her? She's nobody.
She didn't ask him anything. She didn't approach him and request anything.
She knew.
She tried to approach him silently without any knowledge of anybody.
So what's that? What was that about their clothes holding? What was that about their garments?
So apparently, there was this belief that this dignity and power of a person is just as impurity can be transmitted through contact,
uh-huh,
or through contact of a person's possessions.
Not even their skin, their clothes, then.
Uh-huh.
Or through something that a person has had touched.
Wow.
Have you ever read The Robe? It's a novel. It's a really cool novel from like the 70s or something. And it's obviously not historically accurate, but it's the relationship between the centurion who supervised the crucifixion and the robe that he won. And it does have magical properties.
Okay.
And
no, I haven't.
It's really good. I mean, as long as you don't expect accuracy,
well,
good.
Well, this has kind of an Old Testament precedent in which, what was it? There was a prophet of God who had, was it Elisha's bones?
Elijah!
I think it was Elisha's bones.
Oh, okay.
And, I'm not certain. It could have been some other prophet. But anyway, a person who had died,
mm-hmm,
was thrown into, I believe it was a kind of a grave with this...
With the bones of the prophet? The
bones of the prophet, and the person came back to life.
From touching the bones of the prophet?
Touching the bones. So from this
idea
of a relic.
Uh-huh.
A relic with powers.
Yeah. Well, and like Elijah's robe being passed to Elisha, and... relics were a person's possession. The possessions of a powerful person might have been considered to have power.
So this woman, all she wants is to have a little bit of that power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, she believes that by touching, she'll be healed.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, she is quite bold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also desperate.
She wanted to live.
Yeah, quite desperate.
Mm-hmm. Live rather than existing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It comes as interesting. Jesus didn't seem to know. How could Jesus not know about the woman? And that he would be surprised at power going out from him without his knowledge. Was he just pretending? Or did he really not know?
I don't know.
Was he trying to get everyone in the crowd to notice her?
Was he calling attention to it to make the crowd notice, or was it that he had suddenly noticed?
Well, according to Mark's interpretation seems to favor the idea that Jesus didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. from the crowd's perspective, I'm sure it looked that way.
And for Mark, the humanity of Jesus is very important.
Yeah.
In John's gospel, it's the divinity. In John's gospel, you read it, and Jesus knows all. He is omniscient.
Yeah.
In Mark's gospel, Jesus
is
very human.
He can be surprised.
Yeah, because his clothes, he can touch his clothes, and it's just like everybody else, supposedly.
So this woman comes up from behind. So Jesus is completely unaware. Surrounded by people. This woman is probably kind of hunched down, trying to weave between the legs of people. It's kind of what I imagine, behind Jesus so as to not alert him in any way.
Or anybody.
You know, she just wants to touch.
She's hoping he wouldn't even notice, and she just sneak back away.
Yeah, and sneak back away and live her quiet life.
Wow.
She's not a person who wants people to look at her.
And now we're all reading about her. I can't escape it now.
So, for Mark, Jesus didn't know. Mark is trying to portray that Jesus doesn't necessarily know or didn't know everything that was going on. So what does this juxtaposition of the crowds... Now, the crowds are pressing, touching. Touching Jesus versus the woman touching Jesus reveal?
Well, when she touched him, there was intention and faith involved, and something happened. Something happened. She intentionally reached out and touched him, and something happened. And he knew it.
And the crowd is just... The crowd.
The crowd is just the crowd. And so Jesus realizes...
They're just being close to a famous person. Wow, I got to see you.
Curious,
yeah. Yeah.
Jesus realizes that power had gone from him. So he stops. The crowd stops. And Jesus asks, why did Jesus cause such a scene? He could have let the woman go. He could have just...
Well, he needed her to realize her faith. He needed her to know that it wasn't just about a relic. It was about you and me. You and me and the faith that you have.
So why did Jesus take time to pause in his urgent errand to heal Jairus' daughter? Why did Jesus pause? This Jairus' daughter is dying.
Well, and why didn't he just say she's healed?
True.
Then and there.
True.
And were there other people like that lady? Was she special, or was there somebody else there that wanted to be healed, or who knows?
Well, there are other people nearby who saw her
that
faith and
too or not?
And said, "Oh, maybe me too."
Yeah.
Well, he's already taking time in walking with a whole crowd around him toward the place where the guy lives.
It's gotta be pretty slow moving in the first place.
What does Jesus' response to the woman tell us about true healing?
It's not primarily physical.
These are the words and what they mean. Your faith has made you well. This made well is sozo, which is also used to mean salvation. Go in peace. Be healed. Or be made whole.
Well, your faith has made you not just physically, but emotionally, a whole person.
She had to be feeling pretty good.
these narratives began, the narrative began with a story of a sick daughter. Now Jesus calls the woman daughter. And the story of Jairus' daughter closes this section. What significance is there to this word, daughter? Is this, it, this is one of the words that ties all, both of these stories together in all three parts.
Well, respect for women, for one thing. Inclusion in his family. Back to the primary healing is not the physical. The primary healing is wholeness and inclusion.
Well, wholeness is not merely the absence of disease, but wholeness is inclusion in all aspects of life. She was excluded from community.
Family.
From family.
From a lot of family life as well.
And Jesus uses a very relational term. Could have said woman, which is a term of respect.
Which is a respectful term, yeah.
But it doesn't imply any kind of relational restoration.
Mm-hmm. What about sister? Why wouldn't he have used sister?
Yeah, why daughter?
Don't know.
A daughter probably there's a
you feel more like somebody's taking care
of
you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In which a father figure, in a society in which a father mm-hmm. is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter, I think, certainly implies that there is this family.
Mm-hmm. Not only family, but being cared for.
Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, and the other daughter is 12 years old.
That story comes to a conclusion. We return to the first. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?"
Mm-hmm.
But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at it. But he put them all outside, and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him, and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat.
No one should
know
this.
No one should know.
Right. We're in the middle of a funeral. And the dead person is suddenly alive. Don't tell anybody now.
But he told everybody about the woman. Confusion.
Perhaps the disturbance caused by the woman was not a distraction from Jesus' main business with Jairus after all. What Jairus needs is not Jesus' immediate and undivided attention. What Jairus needs is the faith in Jesus this woman has just modeled.
Mm-hmm. In other words, the disturbance with the woman is a message to Jairus, among other people.
His response, "Fear not, only believe," was a call for intense faith. Jairus had exercised faith when he came to Jesus with the confidence that he could save his daughter. he had witnessed the healing of the woman, which demonstrated the relationship between faith and divine help. But he was now asked to believe that his child would live even as he stood in the presence of death. Such faith is radical trust in the ability of Jesus to confront a crisis situation with the power of God. The little girl was 12, the age Jewish girls become marriageable, the age they begin to menstruate.
Approximately. Yeah, on your 12th birthday, you get your first period.
The good future Jesus made present in these miracles restored the woman to good health, to regular periods, and restored the little girl to life and to embodied life as a woman.
Recreation of woman in both accounts.
So, a resurrection of the dead had not been witnessed in Israel since the time of Elisha. This is the first instance in Mark's Gospel of Jesus raising a person back to life. What does the statement, "Do not fear, only believe," tell us about faith?
It's the opposite of fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fear is the absence of faith. We see fear a lot in the world today, and oftentimes equated with faith, and that's kind of frustrating.
It is frustrating.
Now, this story is found in both Mark and Luke. In Mark's account, the crowd and all the disciples, except three, are left where the woman was healed. Only Jairus, Jesus, Peter, James, and John continue to Jairus' home. In Luke's account, everyone goes to Jairus' house. And then,
the whole crowd shows up.
Only Jesus and the parents and Peter, James, and John go inside.
Uh-huh.
There's just a little...
Yeah.
Little
the whole crowd shows up at the funeral.
Little differences of detail there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But don't tell anybody that it happened. That would be very
hard. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sure.
I just brought a crowd to your funeral and then raised
and
the dead person to life.
Here's some food, but don't tell anybody.
So we should note that there was enough time to assemble a chorus of mourners. And
this is probably not just the family.
The wailing consisted of choral or antiphonal song accompanied by hand clapping. Since even the poorest man was required by common custom to hire a minimum of two flute players and one professional mourner in the event of his wife's death, it is probable that one who held the rank of synagogue ruler would be expected to hire a large number of professional mourners.
And they probably had been alerted that there was a sick person and they might be needed.
And so they are hired hands.
Uh-huh.
They laugh at Jesus' statement that the girl is sleeping. There's no...
They've been to lots of funerals.
Yeah, there's no emotional attachment. It's mm-hmm. just another...
Yeah.
Another funeral, another ritual that they need to perform. Mm-hmm. In response, Jesus sends everyone out of the room. Why does Jesus do this? Was it necessary that they all leave? Couldn't Jesus have done this with all of them present? That made more impact.
Yeah, it goes back to the don't tell anyone thing.
We should notice that there is no elaborate ritual or incantation, but a simple command.
Back to the woman thought there was magic involved, and this is back to the getting away from that.
Yes, all four of these miracle stories that we see from the end of chapter 4 through all of chapter 5 involve some kind of dispelling of magical thinking.
Well, that's right. There was
in the calming of the storm, Jesus simply makes a command. There is no ritual, no incantations, no sacrifices.
So back then, they would have noticed that. Like I didn't notice that because we don't believe that way now.
Because we're not used to
the rituals
or commands.
But if they saw that, they would.
Yeah, for exorcisms involved apparently some very elaborate rituals to discover the name, the true name of the demon.
Of the demon involved. And storms are often considered caused by demons?
May have been. The sea was certainly considered a place to be afraid.
Uh-huh.
And in
like the home of demons.
In the story of the woman who was healed, Jesus went out of his way to dispel the notion that it was the actual touch that healed her, but rather it was her faith.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And here, it's a simple command, two words in Aramaic or Hebrew. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of, was it Elisha, when he raised the woman's son back to life, he kind of laid on the boy as part of his, you know, has never happened
ritual.
Before, but
ritual.
You know, that's what he did. Uh-huh. There was a ritual involved. Uh-huh. Jesus does none of that. He just speaks. Uh-huh. In the latter part of this account, the language referring to the daughter changes from daughter, meaning someone's female child, to child, meaning a half-grown person, to girl, meaning a maiden. Is there any kind of significance to this transformation in language? Hmm. We see that in verse 35, against your daughter is dead.
Mm-hmm. And then
Jesus in verse
to the child's
39,
father,
the child is not dead,
and
but sleeping.
Little girl.
Uh-huh.
And then command, it is little girl, meaning maiden.
So she was a dead child, but she...
And she's a woman?
Woman, of course. A maiden?
A maiden.
Back to the recreation of woman concept.
Yeah, maybe.
And as we have noted already, this narrative ends with one of the stranger statements supposedly made by Jesus. It's not in quotes, so it could be Mark in commentary. Why does Jesus tell those present at the resurrection that they tell no one when it is only a matter of time before the mourners who were sent out, as well as the rest of the town, learn of what happened?
In dramatic fashion, certainly.
So did Jesus really say this, or is it more likely Mark in commentary?
I don't know.
So he's saying Jesus said that, but it's not in quotes.
It's not in quotes.
It says, and he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat.
No one should know this.
I don't know.
That sounds impossible.
yeah. Absurd.
And he doesn't say that about anything else. Otherwise, he would have not said anything when the woman touched his robe and he felt his power go out. He'd be like, don't tell anybody. Don't see. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I saw that. Shh.
It's seen as prefiguring Jesus' own resurrection, this story.
Okay.
Huh. Okay.
At least in Mark's literary structure, it is it's part of the part of this prefiguring of Jesus.
Okay.
And what is going to happen.
That makes sense. So how does keeping it a secret?
It's part of the part of Mark's gospel secret motif, where the gospel is really not fully understood until after the resurrection.
Would Jairus have kind of gotten in trouble for even going to him?
It's quite possible.
Maybe.
So that would be a good reason not to really say too much about it. I guess. But people are going to know anyway.
But Mark said before, don't say anything.
Right. In many of the healings, Jesus tells the healed to
keep it quiet.
Don't say anything. And, you know, it's part of Mark's concept that the gospel remains hidden and veiled.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery until after the crucifixion and resurrection. So how Mark ends it is probably more of a theological summary rather than what may have actually taken place.
Well, it makes more sense that it's a commentary on the mystery of the gospel until after the resurrection than Jesus actually giving the instruction to try and keep it a secret.
So he's like summarizing, or I don't know.
He's commenting on
the larger message that this resurrection is prefiguring.
Like, there's another resurrection coming up, and then you'll all get it.
And it's funny, because then the next part, he goes back and says, and he told them to give or something to
eat.
Okay.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, this metaphorical, metaphysical, mysterious comment, and then feed the girl.
Yeah,
isn't that funny?
And it returns to the humanity of Jesus. You know,
And
Jesus realizes, she's been sick to the point of death. She probably hasn't eaten in some time. She's probably hungry. Or maybe those who are resurrected are always hungry.
I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah. So did he say it, or is it part of Mark's commentary? I don't know. But it does seem to be part of the metaphorical comparison between this resurrection and the one that's yet to come. That part makes sense.
Yeah.
What do these stories tell us about faith?
Well, they definitely emphasize the importance of a person's faith in becoming whole rather than simply the authority reaching down and
just granting it.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. In both of these stories, faith is really about action. Mm-hmm. In the case of the woman, it was her choice to venture out to seek out Jesus, to touch an action. In Jairus, it was to seek out Jesus and ask him to come. And for Jesus to continue to come even after he is told that his daughter is dead.
So he believed already that he could heal her, but he wasn't sure if he would come. Or was he sure he would come? Does it matter?
Probably not. No, it's at that, I think the key point is at that point where Jairus is told that his daughter is dead.
Right
that,
there.
You know, there's no reason for Jesus to come anymore.
There's no reason for faith anymore.
Don't bother him with that.
Don't bother.
Don't bother
Jesus.
But he's saying, keep on having faith, even though it's hopeless.
Now, these two stories pose challenges because how do we explain and deal with non-healings mm-hmm. in our experiences?
In my mind, the way I think of it is, I think about the story of the fiery furnace, the three men in the fiery furnace. There were two miracles there. There was the miracle that the three men came out of the fiery furnace, and that's the one we usually think of. But to me, the primary miracle was the fourth man in the fire. That Jesus was there with them. That, to me, was the miracle.
Yeah.
And yes, they came out of the fire. But it's like the coming out of the fire is... I don't want to say an afterthought, but it was
secondary.
Like icing... Yeah, it's a secondary miracle. It's a secondary miracle.
And the
primary
only thing
miracle...
You might miss the other one.
Right. The primary miracle
so the
was that Jesus was there.
The
yeah. Jesus was there with them. And here, the miracle, well, you could say something similar. The
that
primary
is so
miracle is that the two women were emotionally made whole.
So living isn't always the miracle, it's what goes on.
Yeah, physical survival or physical healing isn't always the miracle that's needed. Emotional wholeness is what God is really after.
Right.
And that
explains,
is achievable.
That helps us explain a lot.
And the raising of the dead and the stopping of the blood is just physical evidence in that culture that something has happened.
Right. And maybe somebody needed to see that.
Right, yeah. But the real miracle is...
the heart.
Yeah, the wholeness.
So how might these stories illustrate the three parables of chapter 4, the three seed parables, the parable of the sower,
eh?
The parable of the grains, the parable of the mustard seed.
You're stretching my brain.
I have no idea. Faith and wholeness?
Well, the three seed parables were parables of the kingdom. What is the kingdom like? These miracle stories all are illustrating what the kingdom is like.
The kingdom is where everyone is able to achieve their potential through faith.
Well, in the case of the parable of the sower, the seeds are scattered into different
mm-hmm.
soils.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the Jewish religious leaders it's related to the next question but may have been particularly in the time of Mark's audience where there was a definite split between the followers of Jesus and traditional Jewish sects. The traditional Jew, those who still continue to follow the traditional Jewish sects, or maybe even Jews themselves, may have been seen as kind of non-fertile soil. So in this story, it is a synagogue leader.
Non-fertile soil.
That seems to show, at least in one of the stories, that shows some kind of growth.
So you're going back and saying the soil that looks to be rocky or inappropriate for planting, plant everywhere. Don't assume that this soil isn't good for planting. Something like that?
Possibly. They can't judge a soil by its appearances.
And that story took the lowest of low and the woman in some way.
Well, and the unclean woman.
She was asking for herself and he was asking for somebody. I mean, they were just completely opposite.
Well, the unclean woman and the...
He was clean.
Yeah.
Probably.
But the religious authority who is not the traditional... not the category of people who traditionally accepted Jesus.
They were kind of made on the same level.
Two categories of people that might have been seen as unfertile soil for different reasons.
Yeah.
Or the second parable of the seed was one where the farmer plants and then does nothing but rise and sleep.
Uh-huh.
The seed grows and grows to harvest all by itself.
Uh-huh.
And here, I think part of that is that in the case of the woman, Jesus does nothing. All the initiative is taken by the woman. The power of the gospel is not in the effort that is put forth, but rather in the gospel itself.
He's not even shown planting the seed. He simply
heard somewhere.
Yeah, the seed was planted and it spread, and he wasn't doing anything to cause it.
He wasn't cultivating the woman. He wasn't doing anything to make the woman
instigating it.
The power of the gospel, the power of the kingdom.
Power of the kingdom is in itself.
Is in itself.
It's not in you. It's not in the people you're trying to get to believe. It's not in the people who are trying to control it. It's simply in itself.
Well, that's kind of, that makes sense. That coordinates with.
And the parable of the mustard seed had to do with, you know, this tiny little seed that grows into a huge shrub that offers shelter. You know, the kingdom offers shelter, brings
daughter,
people together.
Daughter, you're part of my family. Take care of you.
So, what relevance do these stories have in our modern lives?
Oh, wow. Faith and wholeness.
And it's not always physical. Being whole is not always just a physical thing.
Is there any particular thing in any of these stories that stand out? Maybe a verse, maybe a phrase, maybe a word?
It's also familiar is the thing. Is there anything that stood out to you?
I think I've already said my things.
It's like it has to soak in for a day, and by tomorrow I'm thinking of all these things. They're all so different than...
As was some of the commentary that I read implied, both Jairus and both the woman who needed healing, they were they're used to being in control in their own ways. You know, so how do we try to control our lives? How do we try to control God? What do these stories say about that?
Well, we try to define God and say, here's what God is, and we try to define God for other people and say, here's what you should believe about God, and here's what you should be in relation to God. And that doesn't work.
I like B, where when we talked about how do we deal with non-humans, that really makes sense what you said, because we try to put it in a box. What, like, oh, you didn't heal my family member, you didn't heal me.
You try to explain why. Well, the assumption...
It didn't go my way.
Yeah, the assumption is that if you have enough faith, you'll get healed.
The way you want to be.
Yeah. And if it doesn't happen, then you try to explain, well, here's why it didn't happen, maybe. And that just doesn't work.
Not really, but I do it all the time.
But so much of Christianity tries to say, well, that those people didn't because. And we try to say what was wrong with them that made them not get what they needed.
But we might not see what was needed or what happened.
Yeah. Or maybe they didn't get what they needed because we were supposed to give it to them.
Maybe we didn't actually believe it could happen when they were asking. That's amazing to me that she believed. I mean, that's a pretty big thing to believe.
Well,
after 12 years, that's just going to stop.
Yeah. But I also think that sometimes when someone is asking for something and we're trying to say why they didn't get it, sometimes maybe we were supposed to
do more
help with that. I mean, we can't always, obviously, but it's not just expecting God to just snap his fingers and do it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So what do these stories tell us about who and what God cares about? And is this different from who and what we care about?
Well, he obviously has different priorities, but his priorities are kind of the same things that we need, just we just don't see them the same. What Jairus wanted and what Jesus was giving were the same thing, but totally different. And what the woman wanted and what Jesus gave were also the same thing, but he emphasized that they were different. She wanted a magical healing, and he said,
yeah,
your faith has made you whole, has made you a whole person, recreated you. You're a whole person now because of your faith. It wasn't just because you touched this thing, your physical ailment is gone. What both people wanted and what Jesus gave were the same, but totally different.
And they were totally different people in society, and
he made a point in both cases of pointing out the difference. He pointed out to her, obviously, that it was her faith that had made her a whole person. And with Jairus, he could have simply said the word and her physical illness was healed. But he went to the house. It's like he allowed it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say he let her die for the purpose of, because I don't really think God does that. But somehow he let it happen, so that he could say,
well, if we take,
I'm about here to create whole people.
Oh, yeah, and if we take Jesus' limited knowledge that Mark has been presenting, then
mm-hmm.
Jesus probably didn't know for sure whether the girl would be alive or dead.
Yeah,
by the time
yeah.
he got there.
Yeah,
and he stopped on the way.
Well, it's like he's saying, it doesn't matter what happens. I'm okay with whatever we find. We can deal with it, whatever it ends up being.
Right.
There are various people here who need help. There's a woman here who needs a new worldview and needs her life recreated. We'll stop and do that. And when we get there, we'll deal with whatever we find.
And all you have to do is just believe. And that's all he wants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then whatever we find when we get there, if she's died, well, we'll deal with that too. That makes more sense than he let it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
So what do these stories say about those outside accepted community and about people who we might classify as having wrong beliefs and behaviors?
Mm. Don't assume they're in fertile soil.
Yeah, for sure.
Love everybody.
God treated her the same way. Jesus treated her the same way as he...
You don't have to necessarily push the gospel at all the people who don't want it, but love everybody, and God can work with all the different kinds of people.
Well, what about this magical thinking? What was God's response to it?
He wanted to be clear that that's not what's going on.
He made it a point to...
He made a point of saying...
Talking about
well,
it.
Jesus, made, about, it, Jesus about, made it a point to, after God had responded.
Yeah.
God's response was to accept whatever little faith was there. You know, so this woman's belief and faith was in this quasi-magical thinking.
She
had an Old Testament mindset. And in the Old Testament...
He accepted it to a certain degree. And didn't nitpick or say you have to get rid of that, or he just...
And in the Old Testament, there was a lot of magical thinking.
Yeah. But he was like, he was gentle.
Oh,
look, we can do it this way. And it
but Jesus is just, he's okay with it, but then he just says, and by the way, there's more to it.
Like I said, gentle instead of like, forcing it down people's throats.
And that goes back to the previous question. How should we respond to people who may have beliefs about God, beliefs about religion that we think, or we know, depending on how you want to put it, are wrong, or even...
Or how about people who believe that if I pray hard enough, I will be healed.
That is, that's magical thinking to some.
I think it's just okay to let them, think that sometimes. Isn't it?
I've sometimes actually given the illustration about the Father's Word. Well, I have sometimes, occasionally at work, someone has brought up prayer and healing and that sort of thing. And I have actually given the illustration about the fiery furnace and talked about different kinds of healing.
And what we see and maybe don't necessarily see.
People have sometimes really enjoyed that concept.
The question that a lot of people have. Why did this happen? Why am I so hard?
I'm a churchgoer. I love God. Why did this happen to me? And we just talk.
Yeah.
And I think that's helpful for people. It's not saying, no, you can't believe that.
You're wrong. You can't think.
But here's another interpretation.
Yeah. But what happens when you don't have an interpretation?
Here's another possibility.
Really out there, crazy idea. Then is it just okay to let them kind of...
Probably.
Yeah.
Just love people through whatever.
Which is hard.
I don't have an answer to everybody's weird belief. I don't agree with it all, but I don't have answers to it all.
So what is Mark's proposition about what is most important about the gospel of Christ, about Jesus Christ? What is the kingdom? What is most important about the kingdom?
Emotional wholeness. Relationship. Family. Being part of the family. And I think that being part of the family is the emotional wholeness. Because maybe like everything else, emotional wholeness is not a one-person thing. It's maybe also a community event like everything else.
List a bunch of quotes here. Impurity is not transmitted to Jesus. Rather, both physical health and ritual purity are transmitted to the women. She, speaking of the woman with the bleeding, she refuses to let her life be defined by what appear to be hopeless circumstances. Both events here emphasize faith, and this seems to be one of Mark's concerns in narrating them. Note that the woman thinks, somewhat superstitiously, that merely touching the clothes of such a holy man and healer as Jesus will cure her illness. But Jesus emphasizes faith as the key to her rescue. Mark's presentation of Jesus' wondrous power is tied to his emphasis on the person of Jesus and does not promote an interest in magical powers and practices. The translation clarifies that this is no incantation or solemn formula, but a simple order tinged with affection. Little girl, I say to you, get up. The menstruating woman, in contrast, has no advocate. She seems to be nobody's daughter. But on the way to Jairus' house, her anguished touch takes precedence over Jairus' desperate pleading. Jesus heals first the one who does not count for much. He makes the last first. He enacts God's preferential option for the poor. Note that though the faith of those drawn to Jesus is important, the faith of Jesus is more crucial. What Jesus believes about Jairus and his daughter outweighs what Jairus believes about Jesus or his daughter.
So when you talk about if you have enough faith, you'll be healed, this is Jesus' faith in Jairus's situation. Jairus isn't even the one with the most faith. Jesus has the faith. Jairus has the faith to come to him, but Jesus takes over from there.
Isn't that nice?
And has the faith.
And Jesus' ministry is marked by connections created as he encounters and accepts people whose lives are hemorrhaging blood or guilt, hemorrhaging self-righteousness or blindness, hemorrhaging paralysis or greed. Sometimes he touches them. Sometimes they first touch him. Sometimes the touch is with the hand. At other times the touch is through words, words that rest upon the heart and heal the soul. However the touch occurs, a connection is made. Jesus as a healer who integrates people more fully into community. The woman is one of several figures in Mark whose healing by Jesus enables them to be reintegrated into various dimensions of society. The primary effect of Jesus' healing is thus not personal but social. The salvation or wholeness that the bleeding woman experiences, your faith has saved, sozo you, is social and communal. Jesus' healings are one of three strategies he employs to reintegrate social outcasts into community.
Like we were just saying, the wholeness is a community thing.
Faith is the main thing, according to Jesus. The good news in this for Jairus, and maybe for us, is that faith is not a finite resource. Relationship is not a zero-sum game. It turns out that desperation is not a contest, after all, with winners and losers. Jesus' ministry is marked by connections created as he encounters and accepts people whose... I read that one. I must have duplicated that. The fact that Jairus was a synagogue leader who had faith in Jesus must have been of special interest to Mark's first readers in Rome, who lived in the world some decades after the crucifixion of Jesus, years that had witnessed the growing gulf between Jews and Christians. Their own contact with the Jews may not have always been pleasant. That such an important person in the Jewish community could come to faith and cross over to Jesus would especially encourage them in their own difficult situation. But it wasn't a mature faith yet. It was what we might call a timid touch of the edge of the garment sort of faith. Not yet strong enough to bring her openly to Jesus. Also, it was a superstitious faith in the sense that she believed that some kind of magical power resided in Jesus' garments. Fear not, only believe. The present tense of the Greek imperative means to keep believing, to hold on to faith rather than give in to despair. With respect to his daughter's circumstances, Jairus' future is closed. But with respect to Jesus, it is still open. Faith is not something Jairus has, but something that has Jairus. carrying him from despair to hope.